Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Jack McGuire, author of Win the Race or Die Trying, Uncle Earl's Last Hurrah. And I'll review Jacqueline Woodson's Another Brooklyn. Jack McGuire is the author, with Walter Cowan, of Louisiana Governors, Rulers, Rascals, and Reformers. He's been a special assistant to the mayor of New Orleans, press secretary to the mayor, and a councilman at large for the city of Mandeville from 1984 to 2000. He's the author of Uncle Earl Deserved Better, and today we're talking about his new book, Win the Race or Die Trying, Uncle Earl's Last Hurrah. Well, Jack McGuire, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you so much.
I am so delighted to have you here. This book is so much fun. And there's a wonderful testament to your longstanding interest in Uncle Earl. In the back of the book, it's a photo near the end of you. And you're a senior in high school in 1959. And Long was running for lieutenant governor on a ticket with James Noe. And you were writing a paper about him. That's a long time to stay interested.
That is. 57 years ago.
So what kept you fascinated with him all these years?
I just thought it was very interesting, his career. It was kind of ironic because I came from an anti-Long background. My father had been very involved in anti-Long politics and had been the chief administrative officer for Mayor Morrison in New Orleans. But after doing that paper, when he ran for Congress, I thought that, you know, this was really going to be his last campaign. His health was poor. He threw himself into this campaign, left a hospital bed to engage in it. But I've often told people that I didn't think he was running for Congress. I thought he was running for redemption after the events of 1959, when he collapsed at the legislature while fighting for black voting rights, when the White Citizens Council was scratching thousands of blacks from the registration rolls in a number of parishes. He said then that the coloreds have just the same right to vote as I do, and their votes count just as much as mine. And, of course, that was anathema to Willie Reinach and the White Citizens Council, Leander Perez and others, and they wanted to remove as many blacks as they could from the voting rolls. He was speaking at a committee hearing, and he just lapsed into a tirade. He was going to make an apology to the legislature the next day, and he just tore off again. At one point, he, glaring at Senator Reinach, he said, "When this is all over, you can go back to your home in Summerfield where you've got that cabin on the lake. You can go out on your porch. You can take your shoes off. You can put your feet on the rail. You can look at the moon and commute with your God. And then, you SOB, you will know that Negroes are human too."
Wow.
His family was very concerned about his health. Senator Russell Long came home from Washington. Russell and Blanche Long determined he needed to be hospitalized and that it could not be done in Louisiana, where he would exercise his powers as governor. Against his will, they flew him to Galveston, Texas, to the John Seeley Hospital there. Mrs. Long signed commitment papers for him there. He petitioned for a habeas corpus hearing, which was held 2 weeks after he was put in the hospital. But afterwards, he negotiated his release with his wife and nephew by telling them that if they did not let him return home, he was going to file federal charges against them of kidnapping, because they had taken him across the state line against his will. He promised to enter Ochsner Hospital, went there. The next morning, he told his wife, Blanche, he was leaving. She said, you said you would come here. And he said, yeah, but I didn't tell you how long I'd stay. She went ahead of him, signed papers with the coroner of East Baton Rouge, asking him to hold a sanity hearing. He named another doctor as to assist him. And the state police car that was taking him to Baton Rouge, where he was going to go on to his farm in Winfield, was intercepted by sheriff's deputies who took him to the basement of the courthouse. That's when he realized that he was being held again. They had an exercise in curbstone psychiatry. He stayed in the car. They talked to him through the window, and they gave the common diagnosis to commit anyone, which was paranoid schizophrenia. He refused to get out of the car. They dragged him kicking and screaming, and he was put in Southeast Louisiana Hospital in Mandeville. He arranged his own release from there a few days later when a habeas corpus hearing was called for June 26, 1959. He called a meeting of the hospital's board first. He had the director of the Department of Hospital fired. He then fired his replacement, then fired the director of the hospital. The director of the hospital then said, Governor Long is saying he doesn't belong here, and he was released. But this was a tremendous ordeal that he had gone through. I think the best example of the fact that he was not crazy was the manner in which he orchestrated his release from two mental institutions and came home. And he had a panel of psychiatrists, though, with him from LSU and from Tulane. He felt he had to assure the people that he was well, he was fine. They gave a report that he'd had several small strokes that had exaggerated his behavioral characteristics, that he was fine now with no intellectual impairment. He broke in on him and said, that means I ain't crazy. He then embarked on a Western vacation trip, came home from it, ran for lieutenant governor on a ticket that he had Jimmy No head, and he finished third for lieutenant governor, but 60,000 votes ahead of No. Written off now as politically dead, has been, no future, his health broken. He was in Baptist Hospital in New Orleans for prostate surgery, and from there he filed through a friend the papers to run in the 8th District congressional race against incumbent Harold McSween, and he left the hospital after 2 days to embark on a campaign.
Now, this campaign, it seems to me that it is worth an entire book, because you give us a lot of the background of his life, but this book primarily concentrates on that campaign as well. And it's such a distillation of so much of not only the man's character, but of Louisiana politics in general. And you capture that kind of circus atmosphere of being on the stump in small towns in Louisiana. And nobody was better at that than Earl Long, right?
Yeah. Yeah. When it came to invective on the stump, no one could beat him. There was another candidate in the race, a state representative named Ben Holt, but the race was really between Earl and Congressman Harold McSween, the incumbent. And Earl said that Harold McSween's the only man he knew who could whistle a tune, smoke a cigar, lie, have his hand behind his back for a payoff at the same time. I later knew Harold well, and Harold said that when I was a youngster, when Earl ran in 1940 for governor, I heard him speak, and I thought that it was just incredible, but I never knew I would be a victim of it myself. And at that time, he was the last of the incredible stump speakers, making 6, 8, 10 speeches a day. He would have his caravan in which two sound trucks, station wagons with big speakers on top, and a turntable to play records inside it that would precede him, drive around a town or a crossroad, say, Governor Long will be here. Earl K. Long, candidate for governor, is coming. He would send some warm-up speakers ahead of him, and then when he would get there, the sound trucks and the warm-up speakers would go on to the next place and doing this in progression. He gave out candy. He had quarters for kids. He had drawings like a raffle ticket for hams, buckets of lard, sides of bacon, layer cakes for ladies. And it was just an incredible performance that he put. In one of his speeches that I listened to, and I was up there for several days and probably went to 10 or 12 of his stump speeches, he said, "Elect Uncle Earl. Send Uncle Earl to Congress. You sent my brother Huey there to the Senate. You sent my nephew Russell there to the Senate. You sent my brother George to Congress. Send Uncle Earl up there. I need you now like I have never needed you before." And actually, he had been a candidate for governor, lieutenant governor in every election but one between 1932 and 1959. He served two full terms as governor. He completed the term of Governor Richard Lesh, who resigned in 1939. Long took the oath of office as governor for the first time on June 26, 1939. 20 years later, on that exact same day, he walked out of a courtroom in Covington, a free man from confinement at Southeast Louisiana Hospital. And, you know, there's no question. No one knew state law better than Uncle Earl. And as he made clear in preparation for the hearing, that the only way he could be removed from office was if he was convicted of a crime by recall, and that there were no grounds for that.
So where do you rank him in your classification of governors? You think he was a ruler, a rascal, or a reformer?
I think Uncle Earl had a certain rascality to him, but contrary to all the claims, including in one biography of him, that he was an ally of organized crime. Look magazine said they estimated his income at $1 million a year. Uncle Earl really didn't care about money that much, except as a means to run an election campaign or to provide what he called walking around money for his legislative leaders. I think that more than almost any governor, except perhaps for Edwin Edwards, he had a compassion for those less fortunate among us, and he dedicated his career to lifting them up. He had a heart attack 3 days before the runoff. He refused to go to the hospital. He went back to his suite in the Bentley Hotel. He stayed there on Thursday, the 25th of August in 1960. The 26th was his 65th birthday. He got out of bed from under an oxygen tent, sat in a chair, let the press in to interview him and photograph him, told him he'd eaten some bad pork at a roadside stand, right, that there was nothing else wrong with him. And when they left, he got back in bed. He finally went to the hospital after he won the election by about 4,500 votes in the runoff. He appeared to rally, but he died 8 days later in the hospital in Alexandria. He thought that this would be a prelude to running for governor again in 1963, and he probably would have tried to run for governor again if he had lived, but I think it was just crucial to him after all the events of his collapse at the legislature, defeat for lieutenant governor, written off politically by even most of his own supporters, for him to win this election. Several days before it, a cousin of his told him, "Uncle Earl, you ought to just take off for the next several days." And he said, "Ed, I can't do that. I'll have plenty of time to rest after the election." But he said, "You got to understand this. I'm going all out. I would rather win this election than die, than lose it and live." He did both. He won the election,
right,
and he died.
So what do you think is left for us to know about him? I mean, he's had this larger-than-life experience afterwards in film. There have been films about his life. There's Jason Barry's play, Earl Long in Purgatory. He's somebody who's really captured a larger imagination. So do you think we know everything there is to know now?
No, not really. I think actually he was, while as colorful as he is, he was a very plain interesting man. He would let people wander into the governor's mansion and he'd show them around. He loves children. He and Blanche did not have any children. The daughter of his farm manager in Winfield was like his own daughter to him, as was his aide and driver up there, Easy Money Littleton, who had been with him after 1947. He inspired tremendous love by the people close around him. He had a marvelous sense of humor, sometimes directed at political opponents. The old story was that a legislator came to him and said, "Mr. Earl, you know, you promised to pave this road when in the election. I told all my people that you were going to, and now you're not going to." And he said, "That's right." And he said, "Well, Uncle Earl, what should I tell him?" And Earl said, "Just tell him I lied."
I love that.
A reporter asked him how many people he had working in the Capitol, and he told him probably half of them.
Yeah.
And there was the marvelous story of a freshman legislator who went to see him the first day of his opening session. And he said, "Governor, I'm so excited to be a member of the legislature, and I'm here to work for the people of my district in the state. But I want you to understand one thing, Governor. I'm going to be with you when you're right, but I got to be against you when I think you're wrong." And Earl looked at him and snarled and said, "You got to understand this, son. I don't need you when I'm right."
That's so true. So what is your feeling for him? You know, you have to love somebody to spend this much time and energy extolling their experiences and their lives. What is
your feeling? The years, I had assembled a very substantial collection of materials on Louisiana politics, all the political ephemera, photos, handouts, mailings that I placed at Tulane University. I also acquired some very significant papers of Huey Long that I placed there. But after doing this high school paper on Earl, but having gone to maybe a total of 20 of his stump speakings when he ran for lieutenant governor, and then for Congress, and my father had died in the meantime. So I pretty much started getting very interested in Uncle Earl, collected a lot of material with him over the years, talked to people who had been associated with him, and finally did a book that was only a small printing called Uncle Earl Deserved Better in 1995, which was a response to a book about him that had just so many errors in it. And the movie Blaze, which I've always said was good entertainment but bad history. Blaze Starr had almost nothing to do with him politically, and she is put at the center of events in that movie in which she never took part. The movie ends with him dying in her arms in the hotel in Winfield, election night. Well, actually, you know, he died 8 days later in the hospital, and on election night, she was dancing in the striptease district, the red light district of Baltimore. I guess what it is, I just felt that his life's work, his career, and his memory were really trashed by that movie and by the biography by Morgan Peoples and Michael Kurtz that just relied on FBI files that were full of second, third, and fourth hand innuendo and rumor and just garbage. And I think that Uncle Earl just has never gotten the recognition that he should have for his career, because to some extent he was always in Huey's shadow. People always talk about Huey, but Uncle Earl was a force in his own right. One of the people who was close to him and to all the Longs said, "You know, the difference, Jack, is people feared Huey. They loved Earl."
Yes.
And I think that was, you know, a large part of it. He would get in his limousine and go down country roads and call on people. He would give his hats away to farmers. He would fill the limousine when he was in Winfield with all of the produce from the farm to bring back to Baton Rouge to the mansion. One of his state police drivers told me, "Man, we were like a circus." He said, "We might wind up with a hog in the trunk, two chickens in the back seat, Uncle Earl shelling peas, you know, in the car." It was just marvelous. But I think that this last campaign, his last hurrah campaign was just incredible. I think he actually, having had a severe heart attack in 1950, having gone through the hospitalization, losing a great deal of weight, he had started during that legislative session drinking again when he'd only been a moderate drinker. He was smoking. Mm-hmm. He'd given that up. His executive council told me he was taking uppers, but then to counteract them, he was taking downers, that this brought on a nervous breakdown from overwork. But he was not in good health, and he literally in this last campaign drove himself to his death. And anyone who's ever campaigned in North Central Louisiana in July and August in the summer, you know, he would always be in his baggy pants, a short sleeve shirt, mopping the sweat off him with a big bandana. And he would be out there and he would say, "I hope you came out to see a crazy man, but I'm going to tell you something. If you think I'm crazy, then you're crazy too, because you voted for me. You elected me." But it was just an appeal to the people who'd stood by him. He was afraid after he had the heart attack in Glenmora, and Easy Money Littleton told me that he'd pulled up the car, long got out of it to go up on the platform. Actually, most speeches were from the back bed of a pickup truck. And he said, Uncle Earl motioned to him and told him, "Go get me some bourbon." He said, "I need something for my heart." And Easy Money put some bourbon in a Coke bottle, and Long knocked it back. And that probably helped him, with what he was going through. But once Easy Money got him into the car and he refused to go to the hospital, he told Easy Money, he said, "If you take me to the hospital now, once the news gets out that I've entered the hospital on Thursday night before the Saturday runoff," he said, "people are going to think, oh, Uncle Earl is dying, and a lot of them might not take the trouble to come out and vote for me." And he said, "You know, I need them. I need every one of them." And he said, "Would you just put out this story that I ate some bad barbecue and I've got indigestion?"
Well, it worked. He won the race. He did indeed. And this book is so much fun to read. It really is. We've been talking with Jack McGuire, whose new book is Win the Race or Die Trying, Uncle Earl's Last Hurrah. You can meet him Thursday, August 25th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Jack, thank you so much.
Delighted to be with you.
Sing, sing, Louisiana, sing. Sing about the Battle of New Orleans. Clap your hands and sing this song, just a little story of Earl K. Long.
Driving around in a black limousine, everywhere he goes there's a great big scene. All of the folks come from miles around just to see the show when he hits town.
Sing, sing, Louisiana, sing. Sing about the Battle of New Orleans. Clap your hands and sing this song, just a little story of Earl K. Long.
Driving around, setting the state in a whirl, saying, "Don't you worry, just trust Uncle Earl. Climb on the wagon and grab yourself a hat. We'll all take a trip out to his pea patch."
Sing, sing, Louisiana, sing. Sing about the Battle of New Orleans. Clap your hands and sing this song, just a little story of Earl K. Long.
Some say he's wrong, others not so. The rest of the people just don't know. To this one thing we'll all agree, old Uncle Earl is making history.
Sing, sing, Louisiana, sing. Sing about the Battle of New Orleans. Clap your hands and sing this song, just a little story of Earl K. Long.
Sometimes a short, beautiful novel is all you need, all you could ever want. Sometimes an author conjures an entire world in a mere 170 pages, a world where you want to linger, a world you will never forget. That is the magic trick of Jacqueline Woodson's Another Brooklyn. Woodson is a noted author of fiction for young adults and a National Book Award winner for her exquisite memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming. Another Brooklyn is written for adults, but it reminds us how pointless those categories are as we are swept into the lives of four young women in Brooklyn in the 1970s. Sylvia, Angela, and Gigi are already friends in their New York neighborhood when August arrives from Sweet Grove, Tennessee. But soon they are a quartet rather than a trio, and they have dreams. Dreams of being actresses, dancers, lawyers, writers, even as they see women lost to drugs, men, and violence all around them. Each girl has her own suffering. Or, as her therapist says to August, who hasn't walked through a life of small tragedies? Sister Sonia often asks me, as though to understand the depth and breadth of human suffering would be enough to pull me outside of my own. August knows the importance of these friendships. I had Sylvia, Angela, and Gigi, the four of us, sharing the weight of growing up girl in Brooklyn, as though it was a bag of stones we passed among ourselves, saying, here, help me carry this. So many memories intertwine in this story. The blackout in New York, the spread of the Nation of Islam, the girls' early loves, early losses, and later losses, too. The crystalline clarity and beauty of this novel is a rare and lovely thing. The past is another country, so they say, and another Brooklyn is definitely a place you want to visit. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Debut novelist Benjamin Rybeck signs The Sadness, Tuesday, August 16th at 6 at Octavia Books. Defend New Orleans and the Innocence Project present Compassion New Orleans, with a performance by Greg Bright of monologues from Laura Naughton's play, Never Fight a Shark in Water. Laura Naughton reads from The Jaguar Man, and There Will Be Music, free. That's Tuesday, August 16th from 6 to 9 at the Ace Hotel. Michael Marina is a special guest host at the Bank Street Open Mic Thursday, August 18th at 6:30 at the Bank Street Bar and Grill. Patricia Crowley reads from and signs her new children's book, Stories from Grandma, Friday, August 19th at 7 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. B.J. Borg, a law enforcement officer of more than 25 years, discusses research and resources for police procedures at the monthly meeting of the Southeastern Louisiana chapter of the Romance Writers of America. That's Saturday, August 20th at 10 at East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses A Man Called Ove by Frederick Bachman, Saturday, August 20th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Aaron Greenwald, curator and historian from the Historic New Orleans Collection, presents a lecture taking on the tough stuff of history, New Orleans and the domestic slave trade, Saturday, August 20th at 3 p.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. There will be an open mic reading Sunday, August 21st at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Today's guest, Jack McGuire, discusses and signs Win the Race or Die Trying, Uncle Earl's Last Hurrah, Thursday, August 25th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And if you're trying to plan ahead for the fall, here are some events to keep in mind. Start reading now so you can be part of One Book, One New Orleans. The book selection this year is The Baby Dolls, Breaking the Race and Gender Barriers of the New Orleans Mardi Gras Tradition. And here are some important dates. BoucherCon, that great gathering of mystery writers and readers, takes place September 16th through 18th. Dillard University hosts a conference on the Black Arts Movement's Southern Influences, September 9th through 11th. Contraflow for science fiction and fantasy fans takes place September 30th through October 2nd. The Louisiana Book Festival is set for October 29th at the State Capitol in Baton Rouge. Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans, takes place November 9th through 13th, and the New Orleans Book Festival is November 11th and 12th. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.